and interrupted digestion hung in the base of the canyon. The rubble of the bridge lay in jagged piles. The Kappa's jaws were beak-like, capable of snapping through an arm or a leg without resistance. Dante knocked on one of the plates, producing a heavy, dull sound. He cocked his head. "Lou, in the course of your studies, did you ever perform any dissections?"
"No."
"Sounds like it's time for you to learn." While Lou busied himself looking horrified, Dante assessed the creature's anatomy. The plates on its back were up to 2.5 feet wide, not the sort of thing Dante felt like lugging up and down the escarpments and cliffs. Those on the skull were much smaller, but skulls being skulls, they'd probably be the most difficult to cut through. The armor around its ankles, however, was more akin to scales than full-on plates, and with a brief test, Dante determined they were also deflective of nether. He got down, set out an array of knives, and began cutting. The ankle scales overlapped, protecting each other, and it took a lot of time and cussing before he was able to pry one up and saw away at its leather-tough connective tissue. He cut free a thumbnail-sized scale, pocketed it, and detached three more in quick succession. He stood, giving some thought to trying to excavate one of its spiral horns, but again, skulls. Besides resorting to chunks of the fallen bridge, he didn't have any tools for heavy-duty work. Anyway, he wasn't much for trophies. He gave the body one last look, probing it with the nether, which slipped off the scales, but was able to penetrate the eye, nose, mouth, and posterior orifice. No other obvious points of ingress. He knew there was more to learn. But if he stayed in the ravine any longer, they might not reach the place where the light had fallen until dark. Dante intended that day's encounter with the Kappa to be his last. They climbed out of the canyon and continued east up a series of steep slopes interrupted by rock-strewn plateaus. During the more strenuous climbs, Dante had a hard time catching his breath. The air had thinned. Between that and his heavy expenditure of the nether, he had difficulty keeping pace with the others. He was happy for the rest when they stopped at an ice-cold stream to fill their skins. Finally, even the grass had a hard time clinging to the dirt. Peaks reared to right and left. They'd entered the bowl where he thought the light had landed the night before. The valley had little features besides a smattering of boulders that blocked up line of sight. The area wasn't large, however, and the three of them spent the afternoon wandering back and forth across the rocks searching for, well, Dante didn't know precisely. For anything that looked like it might have fallen from the sky in a bed of light. They encountered nothing that fit that description. Or much of anything, for that matter. The land was too high for life to take hold. The day left Dante exhausted, cold, blistered, and annoyed. He barely had the strength or interest in fashioning them a cave for the night. "What do you think?" Ast said once they were installed in it and the sun was dying to the west.
"That I'm 50 kinds of tired," Dante said.
"This is the valley where we saw the light touch down."
"I know that."
Ast went silent, profile illuminated by the gentle glow of the torchstone at its lowest. The man had a tendency to ask provocative questions, then lapse into patient silence once he got tired of being led around by the nose. There was something monkish to it. Either that, or it was simply the ability to sit in one place for hours on end that becomes inculcated in men who spend most of their days in the wilderness. In a way, this lead-a-horse-to-water style reminded Dante of Cali. Except the old man had been far more mercurial, flitting from thought to thought like a strider on a stream. And significantly crankier. And not really patient in any way, shape, or form, let alone in a monkish fashion. Even so, there were similarities between the two men. Or there would have been, actually, except that Kali was gone. Lost in service to the war for independence. And for all the power of the Council of Narashtivik, nothing could undo Aron's summons to the hill below the stars. Dante sat in the cave entrance, watching the stars of the mortal world twinkle, but no lights came. After a while he crawled back into the main chamber, which stank with the ripe odor of three travelers who haven't bathed in days.
"We'll have another look around by daylight, then head back," Dante said, "presuming we aren't devoured by nocturnal monsters."
Ast nodded. Lou's forehead creased.
"Did we see what we came to see?"
"We saw the lights," Dante said. "But if they're telling us something, I don't know what it is, or what more we can do."
Dante punched his blankets into the least uncomfortable arrangement he could manage and put out his torch stone. He had nearly drifted off to sleep when a voice piped up in his ear.
Hello? Hello, Dante?
Dante jerked awake, heart pounding. Though he had created the object, the loon, now delivering a man's speech to him from a couple hundred miles away, he hadn't used his since the day he and Lou had left Narashtivik. After so much silence, the intrusion hit him with a moment of sheer terror, like turning around to discover you aren't alone.
"I'm here, Nak," he said, failing to purge the annoyance from his voice.
"Far superior to the alternative," his fellow councilman said. "How goes the hunt?"
"It's turning up more questions than answers. Today we were assaulted by a creature I didn't believe in."
"Well, that sounds tremendous. Your life is always so exciting. One of these days you really must take me on one of your adventures."
"A word of advice, then. Prepare your order from the locksmith in advance. After we get home, you'll bar your room and never leave again."
Dante glanced across the dark cave where the others slept on.
"Is it important, Nak? Or did you just loon me to chat?"
"Oh, it's nothing much."
Nak sniffed and shuffled parchments.
"We found Blaze."
"What?"
Nak chuckled.
"Thought that might get your attention."
Chapter 4 Blaze gazed dumbly across the table at the Duke. So much work flushed away, along with what might well be his best chance to crack the foundation of the Empire. It was the sort of thing that made him want to give up. But it was important to remain mentally flexible, to acknowledge there were always other solutions, such as the carving knife on the wooden block sitting between them. To occupy his hand, Blaze reached for a cup of beer instead.
"I'm afraid I don't understand, my lord. Didn't you just agree this was a wonderful opportunity?"
Dillinger nodded, a hint of pain to his smile.
"I did. And it is. It's simply the wrong time."
"Wrong time?" The Duke raised an eyebrow, as if Blaze were committing an error by asking a single question, which he probably was. The rule book for discussing money with Bluebloods was thicker than the Cycle of Aron.
"I'm sure I'll kick myself for missing this," the Duke said. "But if capital is currency, most of mine is ice. It froze just after I accepted your visit. I'd hoped it would melt before we met, but alas."
Blaze quirked his head, then nodded once.
"I see. I hope that if a sudden wind thaws it, or if you locate a new wellspring, you won't hesitate to contact me."
"Should I?
Then you won't seek other offers on the goods that have cost you a fortune or three?"
"Sure. And while I'm at it, I'll quit breathing, too."
Blaze forced a laugh. "I'll cut other brush. But cutting trails takes time. If your situation changes before mine, I would love to do business with you, particularly after your hospitality."
The Duke raised a glass.
"Flexibility is the mother of success."
Blaze lifted his beer and drank. Even though he was dying to leave then and there, not just to get started on seeking a deal with someone else, but because Dillinger's abrupt reversal made him suspicious his cover had been blown. Protocol insisted he stay the night. Leaving right after dinner would signal Blaze Pendulous was only there for the Duke's money, which Dillinger surely understood. His staff, however, was another matter. Gossip was just about the only way servants had to express any power in the world. If Blaze were to ride off in the night like a bandit, the manor's boys and maids would light up Setevan with talk of his crass avarice. The disaster he'd currently been flung into would be compounded many times over when word of his character caused the lords and ladies of the court to snub him out of hand. And so he was forced to endure another delicious feast and round after round of drinks. He swallowed his bile as well. The dinner was excellent, though he quickly forgot it. For his part, the Duke seemed mildly regretful at having invited Blaze out here, knowing there was little chance anything would come of it. They drank fine wine on a balcony and spoke for hours about the courts, business, personal philosophy, and all the other subjects privileged men were supposed to enjoy. At last, Blaze retired. He got up mid-morning, made his goodbyes with the Duke, and headed out in his carriage. Autumn light drenched the grounds. The carriage wheels rattled along the ruts of the road. As Lord Pendulous, he preferred to keep his retinue light, a cost-saving efficiency matter, when anyone asked. And so he travelled in the company of no more than a driver and a porter. Both were trustworthy, long-time employees of Lolligan, but Blaze didn't speak a word about the trip. They rolled into the capital of Setevan as the light rolled away from the land. Grey towers fought for control of the city's hills, conical roofs painted pink by the sunset. The thick band of the river split Setevan in two. Entire stretches were so thoroughly bridged, docked, and reclaimed that the water wasn't visible at all. Setevan was among the oldest cities in Garsk, and hadn't seen violence inside its walls for centuries, leaving a mixture of classical and modern architecture in its homes, churches, markets, and state buildings. Everyone would agree it was a jewel. And right then, Blaze didn't give a shit. The driver navigated skillfully through the tangled, jostling streets, avoiding both the snarled thoroughfares and the more dangerous backways. Soon enough, the carriage rocked to a stop outside a four-story corner manor on one of the city's most desirable hills. Blaze kicked open the door, nearly braining the startled porter, and clumped inside. Before he'd made it past the tiled foyer, Taya materialized with her typical abruptness. The sword on her hip had been loosened from its scabbard. She eyed Blaze and made an instant assessment. "He turned you down," she said. "How could you tell?" Blaze peeled off his outer jacket and flung it over a couch. Outside, the air was thin and chilly, but the manor's many glass windows let it catch sun all day. "What if I were in mourning for the cat we ran over on the way in? Then you'd look pretty silly, leaping to conclusions." Taya shook her head. "You'd be upset, but you wouldn't be angry. This is about the Duke." "Of course it's about the Duke. When isn't it? You can be angry about him, or you can explain what happened and we can fix it." Blaze pinned her with a look of dirk-like sharpness. On most occasions he enjoyed having Taya around. She was like a thin strip of steel, unobtrusive but useful in a hundred different ways, particularly in espionage and certain kinds of hidden wars fought far from fields of battle. In other ways, though, she was a right horror. She was all business. Not that she was humorless, quite the opposite. Her mockery was nearly as voluminous and every bit as edged as her knife collection. The problem was she had no time for any words unrelated to the task at hand. She had no appreciation for bitching. For the fact that sometimes you had to blow away the smoke before you could get close enough to the forge to work out new answers. "It came down to money," Blaze said, getting to it. "Specifically, that he doesn't have any." That wasn't a polite way to avoid saying he wasn't interested. You've heard the way he talks about Bossin. Even if he didn't treasure it like his own blood, the business opportunity alone would make it worthwhile. Anyway, why would he invite me to his home if he had no interest in a deal?
To get a closer look at you.
She gazed at him, as if to reinforce the possibility.
So, do you think he's telling the truth about his finances?
Blaze flapped his hands.
Do you? With a person like Dillinger, it's impossible to take a full measure of his debts, credits, holdings, investments, and estates. But the point is to bankrupt him. We wouldn't be attempting to do that if he weren't already close to the edge.
Well done. A great big pile of it. How are we supposed to take his money when he hasn't got any of it?
She rubbed her chin. For most people, this would be a gesture of thoughtfulness. But he'd seen Taya do the same thing when she was expecting a fight.
He just now understood why. She was putting her hands in position to defend herself without making it obvious that she had her guard up.
It's not about money, it's about credit, she said. So the question is how badly he's willing to spend what he doesn't have.
He clucked his tongue. We make him think he's in danger of losing it to somebody else. Are we close to any other deals?
Why would we be? Dillinger was always the target.
We could try spreading a rumor. People love rumors.
Taya shook her head, barely stirring her chin-length brown hair. He's too well connected. To take our deal, he'll have to liquidate assets, secure loans. Do you really think he'll do all that without bothering to confirm with a friend in the palace that you're close to selling?
Maybe. If we got him really drunk first.
That would be perfectly suited to your skills.
Blaze rolled his eyes.
So we float a big rumor and tug it out to sea with a little fact.
We've got a bit of Bossin here, right?
We sell it, let it hit the streets, and make it known we're close to dealing the rest.
Taya dropped her hand from her chin.
As your ideas go, that's not a bad one. As long as we're hunting for buyers, we should explore alternative deals. The Duke is only the biggest target. If we can't take a clear shot at him, there are others worthy of our arrows.
No way. Not unless it's the king himself.
Do you believe you're too stupid to ever come up with another plan to strike at the throne?
That's not what I'm saying.
If so, then you would be happy to fire this arrow at a lesser mark.
Blaze glared down the stone corridor, wishing for a servant to interrupt them, but the manor was lightly staffed, and Taya had no doubt sent their people away as soon as she'd been alerted to the carriage's approach. He slapped the wall.
I'll see about selling the first batch. Start looking into alternate marks for the main load. I'll get you invited to some parties, too. Grease the wheels of rumor.
Nothing for a couple of days, all right? I'm still recovering from the Duke's hospitality. And let me know if rabbit will be on the menu.
Taya searched his face, then nodded. We should think about bringing the goods into the city. If our hook snags the Duke, we'll want to close the deal before he has second thoughts and wriggles free.
Bring it up to the Norrin side of Dolandon, he said. I want to escort it through the human lands personally.
I was thinking exactly the same thing.
Business wrapped up, Blaze headed to his quarters for a bath, some wine, and a couple hours to drop the mantle of Pendulous and be Blaze again. The warm water coaxed the knots of travel from his muscles and the smell from the rest of him. Not for the first time, he was impressed by how deftly he and Taya had taken a leaden disaster and transmuted it into sparkling gold. She was an asset and a half, and one of the core reasons their underground campaign had seen such success and still remained secret. He flicked water from the basin and sank until just the tip of his nose was clear of the surface. There was, of course, another solution to the Duke's refusal to take the bait. To give up and go home. Because what was the point, really? They'd already bashed the Gascon Empire into chunks, freed an entire race of people. That act had been good, righteous, worth fighting and dying for. These men had already been beaten. Even if he was able to take revenge beyond his wildest dreams and kill them all with his own swords, they'd simply be replaced by relatives and power-seekers, every bit as amoral and avaricious as those he'd killed. It was like diking the tide. There was always more ocean. The moment you stopped patching the dam, the roiling waters would flood right back. Even so, the last time he'd given up on everything, he'd become more like those men himself. Devoting himself to destroying them was a far better use of his time. Besides, Modigan was a bastard. Someone had to do it. And these days, wearing his freewheeling merchant's mask was the closest he got to happiness. A good night's sleep refreshed him better than any rationalizations. He attacked the next few days with vigor and purpose, making inquiries, dropping hints, extending coy proposals regarding his most valuable goods. There was significant interest, but he needed the right match. The buyer needed to meet two qualifications. First, to be so filthy, stinking rich that Dillinger could believe them capable of buying all of Pendulous's bosson. And second, to be intriguing enough for Blaze to want to destroy them, should the gambit fail to draw the Duke into the action. He spent a week tearing around Setevan and the chateau surrounding it, wining and dining with the kingdom's most outrageously wealthy and highest-placed nobles. It was taxing, rubbing shoulders and trading quips with these tedious clowns, but at least the food was good. Between that and a lack of time to practice with his sword, Pendulous was a gentleman, not a steel-slinger. He was starting to get a bit thick around his middle. As he made contacts, Taya dug into their circumstances, assessing wealth, vulnerability, and entanglements with the throne. Blaze wasn't sure how she managed this, given that much of what she discovered were literal state secrets, but suspected she was tapping into a Galades spy network the Lakeland merchants had embedded in the capital over the course of the years. Maybe even generations. Even if he'd asked, she wasn't the type to answer. Together, they settled on their mark. Lady Keraday of Rollin, an estate overseeing the iron mines in the hills south of the city. Blaze made contact with her man in the palace, who in turn relayed the proposal to Keraday, who sat on the query for several days before replying that, yes, she would agree to receive Lord Pendulous 5 days hence. Blaze rolled his eyes at the delays and spent the intervening days casually feeding rumors into the great gossip machine of the palace. The mines at Rollin had been active for centuries and may well have been responsible for Old Gask's ongoing expansion into the Gaskan Empire, churning out more hard iron than Galador, Narashtovik, the Western Fringe, and the Norrin Territories had been able to keep up with. The hills no longer produced as they had in their heyday, but even now, hundreds of years and dozens of wars later, they continued to provide their heirs with one of the Empire's greatest fortunes. Keraday was not the ideal target. Her relations with Modigan were actually quite tepid. But her holdings were so vital to the operations of Gask that if Blaze were able to hamstring them, even temporarily, the entire kingdom would be left limping. On the appointed date, he rode south with his driver and porter. Keraday lived even further from the capital than Dillinger, and though the carriage departed at dawn, it didn't arrive until dusk. Rollin was more of a fort than a chateau, though the structure's ancient center had been embellished with fanciful cornices, pillared decks, and so on. It remained your typical great big glob of impenetrable stone, a thing meant to keep the barbarians away from the silver. Keraday's ancestors had been flush enough to have rebuilt it at any point over the centuries. The fact they'd stuck with the brutally practical told Blaze a little something about the woman he was about to attempt to do business with. And her nickname, the Iron Maiden, was more than a reference to the source of her wealth. Inside, he was shown to a sitting room and served the customary tea by a man who let slip that he was Keraday's nephew and thus capable of representing her. By high Gaskan tradition, guests were supposed to be poured tea by a significant member of the household. Blaze thanked him and sat.
Most other nobles would have stretched such a visit over 2 or 3 days, if not a full week, but Lady Caraday summoned Blaise to dinner within an hour of his arrival. They dined in a tower, with a view of the south, the hills outlined by moonlight. Caraday had been married thrice, 2 divorces bookending a widowing, but she wasn't yet 50 and remained handsome. A wavy strand of dark hair looped over her forehead. She wore a thin steel necklace, a simple blue dress with a high collar, and the casual command of someone used to being listened to. "To your liking," she said.
"It's food," Blaise said, upping the gaiety a bit, without pushing it into insincerity.
He'd found it easiest to make Pendulous an exaggeration of himself instead of a whole new creature. "Thus, it's to my liking by default. This particular meal, however, would exceed my standards even if they were as lofty as the Dundons."
"Witty."
A smile crept up on him.
"You've caught me red-handed."
"Have I? I hadn't even had the chance to bring around the hounds." He nodded gravely. "And yet you've found me reaching into my bag of tricks for my false wit. One of the many tools I use to hammer the wealthy into giving me some of what they've got."
The lady snorted.
"Isn't refreshing bluntness a tool as well?"
Blaise bowed his head and tipped an imaginary cap. "Caught me again. Why can't I quit this infernal dance?"
"Because my colleagues demand you to put on a display for them. They know your title doesn't come from blood, but from coins."
"Disgraceful," he said. "I've heard some of those are made of iron."
Caraday smiled in genuine amusement.
"Cash is like feces. It only stinks when it's fresh. Establish your fortune, and your grandchildren will be as welcome in the palace as mine."
"Is that a perk or a punishment?"
She smirked and forked up a spear of buttered asparagus.
"We've discussed the food. We have insulted our colleagues. Are you ready to get on with business?"
"Absolutely. And with gratitude that we don't have to pretend that's not why I'm here."
Blaise scooted his chair forward to buy a moment to think.
"What makes you think you'd like to deal in Bossen?"
"For the same reason everyone wants it. Because everyone wants it."
"Are you one to follow the crowd, m'lady?"
"Lord Pendulous."
She displayed her annoyance the same way a cat displays its teeth while yawning, with no intent to harm but merely to show you what will befall you if you displease it.
"Business is nothing more than learning to provide the people with what they want."
"And lording it over your inferiors," he amended. "But yes, mostly what you say. You should hear all the strange reasons people have for wanting Bossen."
"How many others have you made this offer to?"
"This offer?"
Blaise feigned incredulity.
"None, by definition."
"This isn't a fencing match. It's an opportunity to convince me. You only get one."
"I have made a concrete offer to one other party. I've approached several others, but this is the first time I've extended these particular terms."
"Wrong!"
He raised his brows.
"Do you know something I don't?"
"You haven't extended me any particular terms."
Blaise grinned, retrieved a vellum page from his light jacket, and slid it across the table. He explained the cost per unit as well as the available stock. Caraday gazed at the paper for several seconds, then tapped it with a hand unadorned by rings.
"Done."
"Done?
You're a rare man if you make your partners repeat their consent."
He laughed.
"Done.
With one amendment."
She stared him down.
"First option on all future stock you procure."
Blaise drew back his head.
"I can't promise that. I can promise I'll apprise you if a competitor has made me an offer, and I'll let you know right now that I can get much more."
Caraday sipped her wine and turned her free hand palm up.
"Done."
He lodged in Rollin for the night, and set out within an hour of waking, contract in hand. Back in Setevan, Taya closed the door behind him and folded her arms.
"You look distressed again. How'd it go?"
"Terribly," Blaise said. I'm afraid I like her.
Within 2 days, he made good on the deal with Kerriday, exchanging what Boston Blaze had on hand for a chest of coins fit to bow the strings of his carriage. After, Blaze and Taya returned to their respective circles, trolling for gossip, dropping tidbits of their own into the pool. Whenever Boston was mentioned, a frisson rippled through the conversation. When would it hit the market? Did Pendulous know if any was being held in reserve for private buyers who wished to wear it? Was there more to be bought wholesale? Blaze smiled, shrugged, and implied that much of that was up to the Lady Kerriday. He resisted the urge to contact the Duke directly. If the man was as serious about Boston as Blaze believed, he would hear the news. Approaching him would look desperate. Worse, it would appear as if Blaze had ulterior motives. So instead of throwing a hook directly at Dillinger's face, he continued chumming the social waters. At parties, tea houses, strolling around the markets. Yet he hadn't heard one word from the Duke. "The main shipment has been ported to Dollondon," Tay informed him several days later. "Wonderful," Blaze grimaced. They were in the reading room, which offered a view of the hill all the way down to the river, but it didn't look so pretty at that moment. "Why don't we wait a little longer? Maybe the Duke hasn't had time to make a decision." "It's been 3 weeks since you saw him. A full week since news leaked of your deal with Kerriday. What happens if we wait and something happens to our boss'n?" "We're certain this would be enough to bankrupt her." "With a play like this, you can never be certain. You may as well bet on a goose race."
Taya pushed away from the window.
"Mines are expensive to operate. This deal could compromise or shut down the king's largest source of iron."
He gazed at the conical rooftops.
"At the expense of a woman who didn't support the war."
"Where do you think Modigan got the swords he used against Galador? The blades his men used to kill thousands of Norrin?"
"Well, when you put it like that, it just sounds bad." Blaze stood. "The scheme feels like every other war. The innocent always lose more than the guilty."
It wasn't yet noon. They gathered their small retinue, experienced warriors, all of them, and struck out toward Dollondon, cutting across the wedge of land that separated the two rivers the cities were situated upon. It was a multi-day trip through farms, pine forests, and limestone hills. Blaze had all the time in the world to think, but he couldn't come up with a way to take a second shot at the Duke. Dollondon had taken a pounding during the Chainbreakers' War, but 3 years later, you'd never know it. The bridges had been rebuilt. The burned-down sections of the eastern shore where the Norrin lived had sprouted fresh homes. The only difference between the time before the war and now was the rampart around the northern edge of the Norrin quarters. Dante had raised most of it himself, using his ridiculous abilities to talk the damn earth into rearranging itself into a protective barrier. Seeing it again left Blaze cold. Not so much for its association with his former friend, but more for the power it represented. Blaze had heard Dante was being groomed to lead Narashtovic. He wasn't at all sure that bid well for its future. Cloistered in Setevan, Blaze hadn't seen a Norrin in weeks, and though he'd spent close to a decade mingling with the clans, part of him still wasn't used to the sight of the people going about their business on the eastern shores. Man or woman, none was less than 6 feet tall, with more breaking 7 feet than not, with the bones and musculature to support it. The women's faces were hairless, but the men's beards grew to just below their eyes and were thick as carpets. Prior to the war, Blaze wasn't sure he'd known a single Norrin man who hadn't had a beard. In Dollondon, however, they'd been forced to clip their beards short to show the brands on their cheeks that identified them as slaves. That era was now behind them, yet more Norrin than ever walked around stubbled or entirely beard-free. He hadn't asked, but he figured it was a display of defiance. Solidarity with those who had been freed, but would forever wear the scars of their captivity on their faces. Taya led the troops to the wharves, It smells like mud and dung and cold water. Grimy humans and Norrin lugged casks of goods on handcarts. Others struck deals on corners. Women hauled racks of fish from the shores, set up stands, and called out prices. At an unmarked pub, they tied up their horses and went inside. It smelled like tea and tobacco. Norrin hunched over Nulladoon boards, analyzing the game pieces arrayed around the miniature hills, lakes, and rivers. One of the observers straightened, saw Taya, and approached. Blaze let his right hand move to one of his swords, which he'd carried openly since departing Setevan.
"Taya!" The Norrin inclined his head and glanced at Blaze. "And you must be
Lord Pendulous of Elsewhere." Blaze took out his hand. The Norrin accepted it in a bone-grinding grip.
"Take a seat. Have a drink. Ever played Nulladoon?"
"I once had a friend who couldn't quit. Always looked fun, but much as I'd love to kick back, don't we have a job to do?"
"We have a job, yes. But it's a job that must be done by night."
Blaze clapped his hands. "Say no more. Except to order me a drink." The man's name was Ford, and they killed the remainder of the afternoon, lounging around the tavern, sipping beer, and watching the Nulladoon players spar on their pint-sized battlefields. After a couple of cups, Blaze was tempted to start wagering Nulla on the outcome of the games, but he resisted. It wasn't time for gambling, nor, sadly, for drinking. He was here to make enough money to buy a county. There would be plenty of time for fun once the sale was complete. The sun ran away to investigate what was beyond the horizon. Blaze idled longer, buying pan-fried trout and river clam stew from the kitchen. At last, with the sun long gone, and the only light in the street coming from the lanterns hanging at the pubs and inns, their team departed en masse to pick up the bossen. They drew more than a few glances. The hour was late, and they were about the only humans out and about on the eastern side of Dolandon. Blaze was relieved when their mounts clopped past the last of the yurts and lean-tos pitched on the outskirts of town. Crickets chirped from the grass. The residents had ploughed a passage through the ramparts. As Blaze reached the gap, Ford guided him to the right to skirt the inside of the wall. The carts rocked through the grass. After a few hundred yards, Ford called a stop. Blaze glanced to all sides, touching the hilts of his swords. Ford tipped his head at the wall.
"Well, get digging."
Blaze gaped. "You buried it? Do you have any idea what it's worth?"
"I thought pirates' law insisted all treasure must be buried."
Ford couldn't keep a straight face.
"I'm tweaking your nose. It's right through here."
4 feet up the wall, he brushed aside a tangle of leaves and branches, removed a key from his pocket, and inserted it into a knot in a bough embedded in the dirt. Metal clicked. He pocketed the key, and heaved on a gnarled root and hauled open a door in the side of the rampart, sending Blaze's perspective spinning.
"Oh, come on," Blaze said. "Don't tell me your Nulla is making doors that look exactly like dirt." "I would never dedicate my life to something so ridiculous."
Ford stepped back from the entry and dusted his hands.
"My friends, however, are another story."
The door and the passages dug in the rampart behind it made for the perfect smuggler's nook. Crate after crate of bossen were hidden inside. Blaze helped haul these outside to load onto the wagons. By the time they finished, it was after midnight, and Blaze was ready to drop dead. But they had a proper caravan of gask-smashing riches. They drove it across the bridge into the human districts, then took the north road toward Setevan, paralleling the river. Blaze managed to keep his eyes open until they put Dolandon's outer limits behind them, then collapsed inside a wagon to sleep. He woke up as sore as if he'd slept under the wagon's wheels. He hopped down to relieve his bladder in the woods, then jogged to catch up to the caravan, which was now comprised of 5 wagons, 10 veterans on horseback, Taya, himself, and assorted wagon drivers and teamsters. They travelled in quiet for 3 days, passing travellers, pilgrims, and merchants heading to Dolandun and lands beyond. Leery of camping around strangers, they spent their nights in the woods a few hundred yards from the road. The nights were cold, but the afternoon sun was warm enough to keep the wagons toasty. Blaise decided that, once he returned to Setevan, he'd give the Duke 3 days. Then it was time to offer the bossen to Kerede. If he delayed any longer, the market for bossen might start to slide, a strong possibility, given that it was nothing more than a silly fad. If that happened, the whole gambit would be ruined. Kerede wasn't his ideal mark, but there would be other opportunities to hit the Duke and, by extension, the King. "I'll try to gauge if the Duke's interest has changed," Taya replied to his explanation. "Otherwise, I agree. Once you've lit the arrow, you have to fire before it burns out." They left the river's humid banks and cut northwest toward the capital, less than a day's passage away. The road crossed a few miles of scattered farms, then a field of stumps where the farmers had harvested firewood and lumber, then entered a thick, deciduous forest. The leaves of the canopy enclosing the rutted trail were beginning to yellow. The trip had been so peaceful, Blaise didn't realize they were under attack until the first arrows slashed through the branches. Chapter 5. Dante stood up so fast, his head grazed the cave ceiling. "Where is he?"
"Well," Nack said through the loon, "she refuses to say."
"Why? Who is she?"
"An enterprising lady who claims to have spent the last 2 years tracking him down. She is most interested in the reward you've placed on him."
"So pay her," Dante said.
"Not that easy," Nack said musingly, the same way he might broach a knotty theological problem. "She insists on striking a deal with you in person."
On the cave floor, Lou smacked his lips as if he were dreaming of food. Dante lowered his voice. "Sounds like she's got all the makings of a purse cutter. How do you know she's credible?"
"She refuses to go into details until you've gone into silver, but when pressed, she told me she'd tracked Blaze's activity to Lolligan of Galador."
"It's common knowledge that we stayed with Lolligan during the Lakeland Rebellion. Anyone could draw that connection as proof."
"Hey, I'm not the one asking for coin," Nack said. "I'm merely relaying her terms. How would you like to respond?"
Dante gritted his teeth. "Tell her to wait. We're on our way back anyway."
"Oh? Did you find out what was causing the disturbance?"
"Like I told you, we're short on answers and long on questions. We're also deep in the middle of the God's damn mountains. Please show our guest all the courtesies until we manage to drag our asses out of here."
"It will be done," Nack said. "See you soon."
The loon connection went dead. Dante sat in the dark. Over the years, there had been many false Blaise sightings reported to the Citadel. Dante had expected as much. He'd established a hefty bounty for information relating to Blaze's whereabouts, but even so, with one lead after another taking him down a dead end, he'd become sick of the process. Especially because every single time a new one cropped up, he couldn't help himself from kindling a new flame of hope. Luckily, he was exhausted from yet another day of hiking up a mountain while avoiding being eaten by nightmarish beasts. He got back to sleep. When he met the morning, he found his anxieties were held at bay. They had a quick look around the Talus field. Finding no sign of the light's descent, they turned around for the long walk to Sol. Grey clouds blew in from the west, swaddling the peaks. These stayed calm for 2 or 3 hours, and then,
as if the clouds had been slashed open by a celestial sword. Hail fell in sheets, stinging Dante's hands and head. They bundled up and crunched through the carpet of icy pebbles. At least they were headed downhill, and now that they weren't actively searching for signs, lights, rains of frogs, or deposits of goat entrails, they made good time. The second day into the return trip, they had to pause to gather food. Dante used the nether to spear a couple of ravens. Ast found mushrooms on the trunks of pines he assured them were edible. Lou turned up a couple sprigs of carrots. They quit early to stoke a fire and clean the ravens. It was an unusual meal, and the meat was on the greasy side. Yet after days of privation and hardship, it was among the most succulent Dante had ever tasted. 3 full days of walking and climbing brought them back to the meadow that housed the village of Sol. Smoke rose from the shared kitchens and workshops, ghostly columns in the mid-afternoon light. A few residents glanced their way, but that was all the fanfare their return received. Ast tracked down Vinson, and the four of them sat at an outdoor table shaded from the sun by a tan canvas tarp.
"You survived," the middle-aged man said. "And how was the grand adventure?"
"We fought a capper," Lou said.
Vinson laughed. "No, you didn't."
"Oh, you were there with us? Why is that so hard to believe?"
"The fact you're standing here, in one piece, and not in chunks fermenting in the belly of a monster."
Dante rolled his eyes. "We didn't fight it so much as flee in panic. The only way we could be rid of it was to drop it down a ravine." He dug into his pocket and withdrew the scales he cut from its ankle. "I took these from it." Vinson reached forward, hesitantly, as if the scales might fly up and slice off his fingers.
"You really did it. What on earth would possess you to fight a capper?"
"Like you said, it was either that or be eaten." Dante gave a severe look to the homes embedded in the cliffs. "It attacked us after dawn. I was led to believe that was impossible. I think something's going on in the mountains."
"Such as? What did you find?"
"Not much. Nothing I understand, anyway. But you should let your people know to be on guard. If the cappers become more aggressive, the whole village could be lost."
"It wouldn't be lost, exactly," Vinson said mildly. "I expect our bones would be scattered around this very meadow."
Dante blinked at him. "Lou and I will leave tomorrow. Please send word to Narashtovic if you observe anything else strange, or if you need help."
"I will. And thank you for looking into this. Now, how do you feel about feasts?"
"I live for them," Lou said. Vinson went to talk to a few people, and within minutes, a dozen locals had dropped what they were doing to gather in one of the kitchens to attack kettles, pots, and foodstuffs of all stripes. Dante was puzzled by their vigor. Were they that grateful to Narashtovic's envoys? A meal materialized on the tables. Fried fish, stewed greens, farmer's cheese, roasted quail, thick slices of bread embedded with whole grains. Dante was too tired from hiking to fully appreciate the flour-smudged people thronging around the tables, throwing plates of food at him, yet it lifted his spirits. If they'd forged a new connection with these people, and repaid, to some extent, the Easterners' aid during the war, then perhaps the trip hadn't been a waste after all. At sunset, he approached Ast. "Thanks for showing us the way. It was a bit of a trek, wasn't it?" Ast smiled wryly.
"Anything to help this land. It's a tough enough existence as it is." "I know the feeling."
They shook hands. At dawn, Dante was among the first to rappel down the cliff and have a look around the vacated village. There were no tracks or capper spoor. He signaled to the cliffs and others climbed down to solid ground. After a meal and a few goodbyes, he and Lou walked across the meadow, descended the stone staircase, and began the long trip back to Narashtovic.
So, is it true, Lou said.
Is what true? Dante said.
That they found Blaze?
Dante gazed at him sidelong.
You were listening in?
Not on purpose, Lou said. It's not like I had much choice. That cave was so tight you could hear a cricket fart.
Wouldn't that be extremely noisy?
Dante pulled up his collar against the cold. I don't know if he's been located. These reports come in all the time.
I met him a couple of times, the young monk mused. I was just an acolyte, but he was always pleasant to me.
He occupied a curious niche in the citadel. Dante stepped over a fallen branch, strewn across the switchbacked trail. For years he had no official position or power of his own. Some of the council regarded him as nothing more than my servant. I think that left him sympathetic to all who had a similar role.
I don't know. I just thought he was a nice guy.
They traveled on foot for 2 days, sleeping in cliffside caves. At last, they reached the lowlands and retrieved their horses from the gates of the mountains, a modest town that marked the unofficial boundary between civilized lands and the scattered mountain people. The glassy yellow autumn light shined on fields of grass gone to seed and farmers nearing harvest. Gusts of wind raced from the west, watering Dante's eyes. After so long in the mountains, the neutral air felt warm and welcoming. After so many nights of blankets in caves, the beds of the inns felt like magic. Miles outside Narashtivik, the plains were replaced by pine forests. The road was dotted with light traffic, farmers and peasants on foot, dressed in long jackets that swished below their knees, wagons and traders, too. The forest ended. Across the plain sat Narashtivik. For the finale of the war, Modigan's troops had marched right into it, but the battle had centered on the sealed citadel and lasted a single day. Prior to that, the 10,000 redshirts mustered against the city had accomplished plenty of looting, burning, and killing, but by the standards of war, the damage had been slight. While the fringes of the city were thick with abandoned and ruined houses, those had been there for decades, centuries in some cases. Narashtivik had a long, long history. The Chainbreakers' War was just the latest in a string of conflicts. Whatever damage it had caused, Narashtivik continued to enjoy a renaissance. Dante and Lou rode to the outskirts of the city. On Dante's first visit, this had been a forest of young pines, sprouting in the ruins of old houses. But these trees had made for easy firewood, and the last of them had been chopped down years ago. Much of the lumber had been used to build new homes, many of which were a patchwork of blonde timber and old stone. The land was patchwork, too, with small homestead farms bordered by fieldstone fences. Though the city had a well-managed granary, one of the key strokes of the war had been securing a supply of wheat from Tatonin, another former Gascon territory that sprawled 200 miles to the south. Late that summer, as the king's men rolled through the Norrin territories, displacing clans, villages, and entire towns, Narashtivik had funneled the Tatonin wheat to the refugees, saving countless lives. The lesson was that, in times of crisis, there was no such thing as too much food. On the conclusion of the war, Dante brought this lesson before the council. Like everything else, the institution had been depleted by the fighting, but it still boasted many formidable members. Ollivander was the commander of the military and currently the acting regent, and possessed a strong logistical mind. Somber, the spymaster, had travelled extensively, observing all kinds of municipal programs and arrangements, and had the keenest understanding of politics and their consequences. And Tarkon was as old as the hills, and had lived in Narashtivik all his years. His understanding of the city and its people was second to none. Between them, they'd hammered out a simple agreement. Any citizen or immigrant
who wished to farm the city-owned land could do so. Narashtivik's soldiers, who no longer had much soldiering to do, would even assist them in the construction of their homes and the cleanup of their land. This would cost the homesteaders nothing, but in the event of war or emergency, the city would be allowed to purchase all the farmers' excess food at a steep discount. It had worked out as well as they'd hoped. Hundreds of family farms cropped up around the city's borders. Thriving markets emerged in the formerly quiet streets of the outer districts. Merchants arrived to act as middlemen, porting the excess to Dolandan, Yarlan, and the harsh lands of the northwest coast, where storms and rough terrain made large-scale farming impossible. In one sense, setting up programs like this was extremely tedious. In another sense, however, administering Narashtivik and its lands was like a massive real-life version of Nulladoon. With the citadel located in the center of the city, Dante rarely had any call to roam around the edges of the city. As he and Lou rode in from the hinterlands, it was deeply rewarding to see the effects of his policy on the Commonwealth. They passed through the Pride Gate, the first of the two walls. These neighborhoods had prospered too, row houses and storefronts packing people into each block. Dante wasn't wearing the black and silver uniform of Narashtivik, and despite being on horseback, he was often forced to maneuver around lumbering wagons and knots of haggling traders. The city was thick with the smell of dung, equine and human, mollified somewhat by baking bread, diverse perfumes, and the smell of hot black tea wafting from countless stalls, public houses, and shops dedicated to its consumption. Dante crossed beneath the inn gate, into the heart of the city. A cluster of hills dominated by two structures, the Cathedral of Ivers, which flung its marble spire nearly 500 feet into the sky, and across from it the sealed citadel, a titanic block of granite encircled by a 30-foot wall. The gates, as always, were closed, but the guards manning them were quick to spot Dante. The grill opened with an iron screech. The guard shouted greetings. The handful of troops, acolytes, and servants in the courtyard glanced his way and inclined their heads. Dante nodded back. Groomsmen hastened to see to the horses. Dante dismounted stiffly, sore from days of riding. He'd hardly made it inside the front doors before he was intercepted by Gant, the citadel's majordomo, whose pale skin and facility for seeming to be everywhere at once prompted speculation that he moved faster than sunlight. "Lord Gallant," Gant said to Dante in his exquisite accent, sheer Narashtivik stevedore, yet somehow Gant made it sound as elegant as brushed nickel. The man himself was as thin and sinewy as a riding crop. "We are blessed to have you back. Was your trip satisfactory?" "We have fulfilled some of our hazy objectives," Dante said. The majordomo turned to Lou. "And you?" The young monk shrugged. "Always nice to be allowed out of the city." "Excellent. Lord Gallant, I am certain Ollivander will want to see you at the soonest opportunity." "And I want a flying carpet," Dante said, "or at least a narrower horse. Where's Knack?" Gant cocked his head. "I expect he is in his quarters. Should I let him know you will see him after you've spoken to Ollivander?" Dante chuckled at the man's polite manipulation. "How about the opposite?" "I don't believe such an arrangement would please Lord Ollivander." "Then you're just the man to smooth his ruffled feathers." Dante smiled at Gant and jogged through the cool stone foyer. Gant knew better than to make any serious attempt to stop him. Dante entered the stairwell to the upper floors where most of the council kept their rooms. Sunbeams cut through the bubbly glass windows. His footsteps racketed up and down. After a long climb, too long really, considering the age of many of the council, though many of them rarely left their floor, he exited into a hallway. This was lit by lanterns and sparsely decorated with tapestries woven with the image of Bardon, historical battles, and so forth. Dante barely saw them as he approached Knack's door,
and knocked 3 times. Knack answered promptly. He wasn't the most dashing figure on earth. Short, pudgy, middle-aged, and almost but not completely bald. Nor was he the bright